Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Mike Reeser, and he'll be answering your most important questions on roosters in the surf. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Mike a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Mike Reeser about roosterfish in the surf. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as a seasonal snook or tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to his website at www.flatstime.com. That's FLTSTIME.com. Before we introduce Mike, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. And for our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So you have 2 chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, go to our homepage now at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Mike's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Just click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a selection of saltwater flies courtesy of Mike Reeser. These flies are the same flies he uses in Baja to catch many saltwater species. So here's how you can win those. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question is going to be about something we talked about tonight on the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and your location using that text box on our homepage, the same place where you can ask questions. So listen closely at the end of the show and use your best typing skills, and the first person to submit the correct answer will win that selection of saltwater flies. Tonight, we welcome Mike Reeser. Mike got the fly fishing bug some 45 years ago at the impressionable age of 10. A keen interest in fly tying quickly followed with raids on his mother's sewing kit and gathering of feathers and fur from reluctant barnyard critters. In 1973, Mike made his first trip down to Baja, where he would spend the next 15 winters camping on the beaches and fishing flies in his new fly fishing frontier. A great deal of time was spent camping and fishing with the handline fishermen, the Panjeros, who, despite their skepticism about fishing the wimpy rod, shared their knowledge of the Sea of Cortez and its great variety of fish. Through trial and error, the methods evolved to catch many species, such as roosterfish, once deemed impossible on the fly. This foundation of knowledge and experience would eventually lead to the foundation of the Baja Fly Fishing Company in 1997. Always innovative, Mike has developed tactics and fly patterns effective on a wide variety of species that swim the Sea of Cortez. Mike and the other guides at Baja Fly Fishing spent considerable time in the pursuit of roosterfish, with many large fish landed by Baja Fly Fishing clients each year. Besides guiding on Baja, Mike has also worked as a fly fishing guide since 1974 in the Sierra Nevadas and the Rocky Mountains. He ties flies commercially and worked as a saltwater fly fishing advisor for Fly Fishing Destinations TV show. The Baja Fly Fishing Company has been featured by Warren Miller Productions, the Ron and Raven Show, Fly Fishing Across America, and Michael Falk's Productions. Mike, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Oh, it's good to be back. Good to be back. In fact, I just got back from the Baja, and we'll be headed back down in about another week.
Was it as hot down there as it is up here in Colorado?
No, you know, actually this is the second year that we've had of some fairly, you know, by Baja standards, pleasant weather. We've been running mid-80s. Humidity hasn't come up much yet, and we've been getting a nice breeze in the afternoons. Actually, I got back here in Colorado and thought it was kind of hot.
Yeah. Well, you're a little cooler up there in Craig, but down here in Denver, it's in the 90s, and it's sweltering, to say the least. But, well, good. Well, we did a show in the past with Mike about a year ago or so, and we talked generally about fishing for roosterfish, but since then Mike has honed his skills and documented the methods and tactics that have been successful down there, and wanted to share even more in depth on strategies, tactics, presentations, and so forth. So tonight we'll spend a little bit of time just to get acquainted with the fish, but not as much as we did last time. And if you're interested in getting a background for tonight's show, I suggest you go in the archives and search for Rooster Fish and Mike's show, and then you can get another show that will educate even further about Rooster Fish. So, well, Mike, yeah, let's just start from the beginning here with the Rooster Fish. And now you fish roosters primarily in Baja. That's where you have your guide service. But do they also live anywhere else in the world?
Yeah, actually, the Baja is kind of the northern end of the roosterfish's range, and they're found really only on the Pacific coast of the Americas. So basically from Peru up to about the midpoint in Baja California, and I have had the privilege of pursuing them in Guatemala and Costa Rica.
Ah, okay. And are they similar down there in size and so forth?
Yeah, very similar, and the same tactics that we utilize on the Baja works for those Central American rooster fish, as well as up into the Zihuatanejo area of southern Mexico too. We're another good spot to find rooster fish.
Okay, great. Now, are they migratory, seasonal at all?
They're definitely seasonal, and there's still a lot that we don't know in terms of their actual migrations, how far they go, but we see them start to show up, the bigger fish anyway, start to show up about, sometimes as early as early to mid-March. They are on the Baja, at least in the East Cape area where we fish, into November. But the big fish are primarily available along the beaches, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight is beach fishing, really getting into the period of April, peaking somewhere in the late May to mid to late June. And then we start to see a dispersion. I believe that part of it's their mating cycle. They go off to other places, but they come back and forth. But the big concentration of fish is that May-June period.
Okay, so early spring into summer just a bit. And how big do they get, and how fast do they grow? Are they?
Well, the all tackle record is over 100 pounds, and it's, I believe, somewhere around 106 or something like that. I'm not really sure. Fly rod record is just over 60 pounds, and there are occasionally reports of some fish fly rod caught that were never registered for records in the 70s. As to how fast they grow, they're fairly rapid growing, at least in their earlier stages. In the juvenile fish that we see down there that are maybe a pound in size, gain quite a bit of weight, and we start seeing them, you know, in the 4 to 6 pound by the fall of the year.
Now, the picture that we just put up today of you with the rooster, what size fish is that? How many pounds is that here?
We guess that fish about 45, 47 pounds, and that is a good-sized fish, and we saw quite a few of a fish that size, last year and this year.
Okay, and what's an average fish? If a guy goes down there, you know, what's the average size he might catch?
You know, we really look at roosters in the juvenile category, the little guys, and then what we call the medianos, the middle-sized fish that run up into about the 15-pound range. And in that size, I would say an average fish that we catch on any given day is probably in the 4 to 6 pound range. Then you jump up into a whole different class of roosters, and these are the big fish, what we call the grandes. And probably an average in that size range is maybe low 20s. But it seems that, you know, we'll get runs of fish that'll all be pretty much even size. So we were seeing this year for several weeks, fish that were right in that 40 to 45 pound range.
That's a nice fish. And for any kind of fish, that's a nice fish.
and these fish are just incredible, especially when you get them to this size.
Now, we had a question from Frank up in Lanceville, British Columbia. He wants to know what the best place to fish for rooster fish. And now I know you're partial to Cabo, but...
Well, of course I'm going to tell you the East Cape area. But actually, the East Cape area has been noted as the rooster fish capital of the world. And there's a lot of things that happen right in there in terms of being an ideal spot. It catches a lot of plankton drift, and you get the mullet right behind it, and it's a very good spot. So the East Cape beaches in around what's commonly known as the lighthouse is a good spot. Going north of the area that we work, Punta Arena up along Sorabo Island is another hot spot. Some of the islands off of north of La Paz up to Loreto are good. And then there's some very good beach areas between Cabo Frejus running around to the Cabo San Lucas area. And up the coast up towards Todos Santos has rooster fish hot spots.
Okay. Moving on to equipment. I know when you go down there, and I know you encourage people to, and you do, fish for other fish other than roosters, but if we're just focusing on roosters here, and speaking of fishing for them, you know, in the surf zone, what Angela wants to know what the ideal rod is, and he suggests a 10-weight, but what is our ideal rod for that area?
Actually, a 10-weight is right in there. It's not such a heavy stick that you don't enjoy the, you know, 2 to 4 to 6 pounders, the smaller jacks, the ladyfish, some of the other incidental fish that we catch out of the surf. And it will handle most of the flies that we throw. Now, if you're into a run of really big roosters, you're starting to get in that 40-pound class and all, I do like to carry a 12-weight. We throw some big flies, some big air-resistant flies, and the 12-weight rod will push those big flies, especially if we get out a windy day. But 10-weight is a good rod. A lot of people, that's all they carry and catch some very big fish on that.
So you do catch incidental fish as well while you're fishing for roosters, but...
We do, and part of our routine is to take advantage of that. We'll a lot of times start fairly early in the morning when the light is low, and it's hard to really spot the bigger fish. And they don't really even seem to be working. So we do a lot more structure, fishing around structure, and blind casting and picking up some of the other species. As the sun gets up where we can see and the wind starts to push the plankton in on the shoreline and the mullet congregate, then we're looking sight casting for the big roosters.
Okay. Now, back to the rods themselves. I know you're in the process of writing a book about fishing in Baja, not only with roosters, but other fish as well. That's correct, right?
Yeah. It's an exciting project, and I've been working on it for the last couple of years.
In that, the draft that you had sent me over that I was looking at, you had talked about the differences in the materials used in rods today and so forth, specifically for saltwater. Can you go into that a little bit on your thoughts on that?
Yeah, one of the things that, and I talk about in the book, that we came very quickly to realize as we really got into some of the, especially blue water species, was that the brittleness of graphite. And there's several rod manufacturers now that are putting fiberglass back into at least the butt sections. The Cam Ziegler rods, the Temple Fork blue water rods are two good examples of manufacturers that are addressing some of the very specific types of situations that we encounter with these really big fish, where you need the lifting capability on these guys that you just don't get with some of the graphite rods. They're wonderful casting tools, and so we kind of look at utilizing really both the high quality casting type of rods and the heavy lifting rods that are have a fiberglass component to it.
But you'd also mentioned something about that there's a bigger chance of a rod shattering down there due to defects or a nick in the rod, you know, a lure or fly hitting the rod. Is that specific to graphite that you were talking about?
Yeah, graphite is more susceptible to that sort of damage. Yeah, it can be from a defect, although I have to say really in the last five, six, 7 years, I've seen a lot fewer of our graphite rods blow up, but quite often its fish fighting technique has a lot to do with rods being broken, whereas the rods that have fiberglass in there are a lot more forgiving of less than stellar fish fighting technique. But also too, you know, especially if you're on a boat and you're pitching and all, and fish goes underneath the boat, it's a lot of times hard to control the angle of the rod and attack on the fish.
Right, right. But that, you know, I mean, that's something when you're fishing for trout up here in the Rocky Mountains or where you're not faced with a rod blowing up. I mean, that's...
No, in fact, it's fishermen that we have the hardest time with because they're so used to high-sticking the rod when they set the hook on a fish. And you get that nice little candy cane in a rod on a heavy fish down there, and you're just about sure to break the tip section out. So I sometimes... Well, gently tap people on the back of the head as a reminder that they can't high stick these fish. You got to keep the rod angle low.
In fact, when you're playing them, many times when they talk about this down and dirty, you're actually sticking the rod in the water and so forth, right?
Oh yeah, there's on a pumping technique. One thing that we do a lot of coaching with people even before they ever get out and start to fish on how to play fish. We start the pumping technique actually with the rod tip in the water to be able to gain as much line every time that you lift the rod as you can. We, even on billfish, we've taken to initially sticking the rod tip into the water on the take to try to get as much belly line in there and get a low angle set to the hook on the fish where you're pulling back along the lateral line and not back up to the roof of the mouth. So we do. We employ a lot of techniques that would be at least at first a little foreign to people who have been trout fishing, but they make the transition really quickly.
Yeah, almost by pure force, right?
Well, yeah, and like I said, we do a lot of coaching and teaching before they even get on the water, so they're familiar with whatever terms we throw at them in the process of playing a big fish.
All right, what about reels? You wrote a lot in your book about reels, and we always see those pictures of those blowing up in salt water. So what do you recommend there?
The thing on reels, I think the blowing up of reels and all sometimes comes from tightening the drags down too tight, especially initially. There's kind of two thoughts on drag systems and how you utilize drag. One is incremental increases on the drag as you play the fish and the fish tires. We go the route of setting our drags initially 4 to 5 pounds pressure, and then we don't touch them. We let the fish run against that, and then as we get the fish closer to the boat, then we use palming pressure, line pinching techniques. It's very quick to release that if the fish makes a sudden surge. And if you do that, you very seldom ever see a reel blow up. The reels built today are much better overall than what we used to find. The very high dollar reels of 30 years ago were very good, and everything else could be suspect. But there's a lot of very good reels on the market today, and what we look for is a good sturdy foot on where it attaches into the rod, no slack in terms of the spool revolving, smooth startup on the drag system, and large arbors. The ability to collect line quickly is absolutely essential with almost all saltwater species.
And when did you just say pitching line? Is that what you use the term?
Pinching. Yeah,
that goes right
back to my old steelhead and salmon fishing days of once you got the line back on the reel of just pinching the line against the cork of the drag, that works as effectively as palming. And what it does is it gives you the ability to release pressure on that fish if they make a sudden surge away from the boat, which is quite common. You get a rooster in close to you on the beach and they can revive and speed off. And if you don't have the ability to instantly let off on the pressure, they'll quickly break that leader.
Okay. Well, we need to take a quick break here, but when we come back, we'll talk more with Mike about fly fishing for roosterfish. At Housatonic River Outfitters, we offer the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fly fishing trips or drifting the river with our guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, we offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing guide trips for warm water species as well. Please tour our website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services we offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. We were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services, and we have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Mike Reeser about roosters in the surf. If you'd like to ask Mike a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. Use that Q&A text box to send us your question, and we'll answer as many of your questions tonight as possible. Now, Mike, just briefly give us a rundown on your business down there, what you do, what the services you offer, and so forth. So in case people would like to use you, they'll know a bit about you.
Well, we're a full-service guide service. By that, I mean we handle all of the travel transfers once they're in country. And once we're there, we are there with the clients for the full day. It starts at breakfast, and it goes till however late they want to sit up and talk and ask questions and relive the day. We do a lot of seminaring in our approach. If people are interested there, we've been doing this for quite a while, and we truly enjoy sharing that with folks, and the guides that work for us do as well. So it's a very, very much a personal touch in the service we provide. And we provide guide service, saltwater seminars, both the beach, near inshore on the Pongas, and as well as the blue water stuff for the tuna and dorado and billfish.
Great.
And we work out of the Van Warmer resorts out of Punta Colorada, Playa del Sol, and Palmas de Cortez, all basically right there on the East Cape between Los Pariles and the little town of La Ribera.
Now, when you say the East Cape, how far is that? A lot of people know where Cabo San Lucas is. How far is that from there?
Oh, yeah, everybody knows, has heard about Cabo Wabo and all. Now, we're about 45 miles north of the Los Cabos Airport, which is actually up in San Jose del Cabo. So, in terms of a time frame from the airport, we're about as far north as Cabo San Lucas is south of the airport.
Oh, okay.
Basically, we're the first spot that you hit going north from the Los Cabos area on the Sea of Cortez.
And what's your website? How can they get a hold of you?
They can get a hold of us at www.bajaflyfish.com.
Okay, www.bajaflyfish.com. Phone number you want to give?
Yeah, we've got an 877 number, 877-572-5012.
Terrific, terrific. Well, thanks for sharing that with us. And, folks, good place to get some guide service if you want to go down to Baja. So, well, let's talk more about equipment here, and then we'll get into flies and tactics here and delve deeply into that area. Lines. We're talking there in the surf zone. What kind of lines do we need to have for the roosters?
The most common line that we use is a full-length intermediate line. It serves a purpose in terms of being able to if you want to throw poppers, crease flies, it is good for that, yet it has a small enough diameter that gives you more capacity on the reel than, say, a full floater. There's a place for floating lines. A lot of it has to do with the comfort level of the person casting. First time they get into fairly choppy water, trying to pick up the fly quickly off the water and reposition it, a floating line can be a little easier for someone in their first day or so down there and then transitioning into the intermediate line. But there's also a place for the sinking line. So, you know, most everything, once that fly hits the water, we're retrieving it almost immediately, especially on side casting to fish. So whether it's an intermediate floating or sinking line, basically the fly is traveling just at or under the surface.
Now, do you switch up out there? Are you primarily, using the intermediate in most situations?
I would say the intermediate covers 80% of what we do. One of the advantages to, say, one of the sinking, high-density sinking lines or some of the integrated lines that are coming out today where you've got, say, a 28-foot high-density sinking line that integrates into the running line is on a windy day, you've got a lot less wind resistance against that sinking line, and especially if you're dealing with a crosswind, which is quite often the case when we're working on the beaches. Summertime, we get that southeast wind, and it kind of pushes the fly right in on the shoulder of a right-handed caster, and that the thinner profile of the sinking line will cut through that a little bit easier.
Now, when you say sinking line, are you sinking tip or full sinking line?
There would actually be like a sinking tip. Well, all of the line manufacturers now make something kind of along the lines of the original teeny lines where they took a shooting head and pretty much welded it into a running line with a bit of a back taper to kind of take that hinge out. Shooting heads, too, I mean, that's what we started with years ago, and there's a place for them. But I think most people, for most situations, an intermediate full-length sink line is probably your best all-around line off the beach.
Okay, and then we have Frank again from British Columbia wants to know about backing. How much backing do you put on? What kind of backing do you recommend? And then also if you talk about the terminal tackle leaders and so forth.
Okay, yeah, backing... I like to have plenty of backing on the beach. I think there's been some exaggeration over the length of distance fish can run. Offshore, you know, we got the option of chasing fish down with a boat. On the beach, you don't. And I can think of a number of people, myself included, that were out fishing for smaller fish or anticipating smaller fish, like, say, with an 8-weight and, you know, small capacity reel, and Bubba comes along, and there goes the line. So I would say at least 250 yards, 30-pound backing to 300 yards if you're serious about the big roosters and big jacks. And we're still using Dacron line down there, and again, a lot of it has to do with the fact that we run a guide service. The Spectre line is great if you've got somebody that's experienced and is winding the line smoothly back onto the reel, not letting it bunch up to one side or not. So it's kind of a person's choice, really, if they want to run, say, 50-pound Spectra or 30-pound Dacron. But I don't go less than 30-pound Dacron. We found that the 20-pound gives you more capacity, but, boy, if you get a nick in that stuff, you can break off at the line, especially when you're dealing on sandy beaches and that.
Yeah, more abrasive areas to deal with.
Yeah.
The type of leaders that you use in the terminal tackle, you want to describe that from the line down,
yeah, there's
knots to use and so forth.
We've been going more and more to a ferrule leader system. It certainly isn't a necessity or anything, but we like it, and we spin them either on a drill or actually most of us all tie on rotary vices, and it's a real fast leader to put up. So about 2 foot of it is actually is the ferrule section. It goes into a single strand of 30 or 40 pound test, and what that does is it gives you good turnover, but also too, it tends to spin a little bit on a sharp jerk, and we have found that that protects the knots fairly well. More commonly, we've been using over the years 3 to 4 foot of soft 30 or 40 pound mono for the butt section. Perfection loop on either side of that, and loop to loop into a loop on the fly line, and then 3 to 4 feet of 15 or 20 pound class leader that we loop into the butt section. Generally, we're not fishing longer than a 9 foot leader, and in most situations, a 7 to 8 foot of leader, especially with the clear line, is sufficient on the rooster fish. We try not to cross the fish with the leader or the line. We're casting straight on to where that what they're seeing is basically the tail end of the fly anyway. So we tend to keep our leaders a little on the short side.
Well, when you were saying the ferrule leader, is that replace the butt section then?
Yeah, basically it does. I take about 7 foot of either 30 or 40 pound soft mono and tie a little perfection loop in one end, hook that into a vise or a drill, come up about 5 feet and wrap around my finger a couple times so it spins between the vise and where I've got it wrapped around my finger, spin it about 20, 30 times on the vise, and then I basically join it at the center, let it spin together, tie it off with a double overhand knot. So what you have is about 2.5 feet of line that is doubled back on itself, spun on itself, and then you've got about 2 feet below that of untwisted line. So it goes from, you know, a double strand of, say, 40 down to a single strand of 40. And at the end of that, then we put the perfection loop, and then you go into your class.
You said the perfection loop to join those. Any particular knots to the fly? Do you use a loop there or tie directly to the fly? What do you do there?
It kind of depends on the fly. I like to use a loop knot on some of our large deer hair, clipped deer hair headed flies, and I use what's been termed Lefty's loop or the loop knot. Is a good strong knot. If I'm tying directly to the fly on something that's got, say, a smaller head that doesn't tend to swing as much, because we're stripping these flies very fast. It doesn't give them a lot of opportunity to swoop, drop, swing. That knot, we use variations on the King Sling or what we call the San Diego knot. And both those knots are excellent. They have pretty close to 100% breaking strength. And you can find, actually you can find those in a number of books, or you can actually go online. I actually found in researching the book, you can type in Eugene Bend and or King Sling, and you'll find a diagram there online.
It's amazing nowadays. Almost.
It is, yeah.
You know, it's like the other day I said, I was wondering if I can freeze smoked fish, you know, and so I just typed in freezing smoked fish, and boom, there it tells me, you know, and the internet's amazing nowadays. But okay, well, let's. Anything else you want to add about equipment before we move on to flies? And
yeah, the knot connections, leaders, flies, all your connections are very important. One of the things that we've seen when people come down with their own equipment is sometimes the backing connection into the fly line is not up to snuff for saltwater species. And it takes, you know, some vigilance and checking to make sure that your equipment is up and tuned and working properly. On the subject of knots, there's a lot of knots. I go into quite a few in the book. We've tried various knots. One thing that I encourage people to do is there's a lot of good knots that work out there. Find the one that you tie the best and consistently, because the best knot in the world is not good unless it's tied properly. So I encourage people to find what they're comfortable with and tie well.
Would you encourage folks to go down there if they have rigged themselves up to have the guide strip it out and check it and, you know, just...
We do that. In our business, we do provide tackle as part of the package, no extra. But a number of people like to bring their own gear, and what we'll do that first evening if they come in is we'll strip it out and make sure that they've got a good knot connecting the fly line into the backing. I learned the hard way years ago in guiding down there of not doing that, and then the first big fish that takes off and runs, and the knot slips on the backing. So, and there goes the fly line. So, no, we check that out and make sure that they've got an adequate system. And we're very high on loop-to-loop. Loops in the fly lines at both ends, and looping it into a bendy loop on the Dacron backing side.
Great, great. Yeah, that's the last thing you want to do is get a hold of a big fish and watch your line go out because of a poor knot.
Huh? Oh, gosh, yeah, lose a fish, $60 fly line, and, yeah, it's a heartbreaker.
Well, let's talk about flies. Of course, you know, with any fly fishing, we're always dealing with trying to simulate something, whether it be a hatch or a school of bait fish or whatever, but I realize that they probably feed on different things at different stages in their life, but why don't you give us a rundown on what roosters feed on?
Okay. You kind of have, again, I went back to earlier, it's three size classifications. You've got the juvenile of the year, the medianos, and the big roosters. And the smaller fish are largely sardine feeders, other small bait fish along the shoreline. Smaller ballyhoo are quite common for them. But somewhere in that, as they approach 10, 12 pounds, they start to switch from the sardines, and mullet becomes a key food source. And the larger medium size into the bigger fish, definitely mullet, and they'll eat quite a large mullet. Other food sources as they get bigger are smaller ladyfish. We've had the experience a number of times of hooking up on a ladyfish only to have a 40-pound rooster fish come up and swallow the, or try to swallow the ladyfish. We have bonefish down there. They're not real common, maybe because the roosters really like them. And they'll also chase and eat bonefish. So we tie our flies to match the hatch in the sense that if we're fishing sardines, then we're fishing a sardina-looking pattern. Ballyhoo, we've got some adaptations of those same patterns with a little beak on there to imitate the ballyhoos. And then for the big fish, we're primarily throwing something in the 7 to 9-inch range, 10 inches sometimes, that looks like a mullet. And the big roosters, they're inshore along the beaches, usually looking for mullet.
That's a big fly.
They are a big fly. And they can be a challenge to throw in the wind on some days.
Yeah, I can see why you maybe want that 12-weight.
Yeah.
9, 10-inch fly, that's a pretty big bait fish. Now, so are the bait fish then herded into the surf zone, is that where they normally reside, or how does that work?
Actually, a little bit of both, and you'll find during the day, this plays into some of our tactics in locating fish, but the sardines, as well as the mullet, are vegetarians, and the wind action currents and all tend to push the small plankton through smaller pieces of vegetation right into that surf zone. So you have their food source feeding on vegetation. So they tend to be naturally located there. But very definitely, the hunting strategies of these fish is to push the bait fish into shallow water to where that they can't go up, they can't go down, and they can't go on the beach. So it limits the direction that the bait fish can escape. So it is definitely part of the hunting strategy of these fish to push them into the shallows. And that's to our advantage.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we need to take a quick break here again, Mike. But when we come back, we'll be answering more questions about fly fishing for big roosters in the surf. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years, and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about the premier shop by logging onto their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. Okay, Mike, flies. Shane in Alaska, of course, he wants to know what your favorite fly is, and he'd also like to know if there's a recipe available for it.
Okay. Yeah, favorite flies, probably the three that we throw the most is what one we call the Jim Sock, the other's the BBD, and the other's the Baja Muddler. And they're all kind of our own created flies, but the BBD stands for Baja Bucktail Deceiver, and that's what it is. It's an adaptation off of the Bucktail Deceiver and kind of a blend with the Sea Habit pattern. Bucktail wing, it does a really good job of imitating the sardinas. The Jim Sock is kind of an adaptation of the Rasta pattern. I build a little bit bigger, but I smooth the head down a little bit to make it a little bit easier to cast. And then the Baja Muddler is real similar to the Beach Rat pattern that's been on the beach there for a while, and that imitates the mullet patterns. The thing I'll say, that there is no magic bullet. On, on flies. We see people that bring down stuff that work very well. The things that we find that are in common on these patterns, one is that they're roughly the size of the bait fish. That's important. The other elements is that the flies are balanced when they're pulled through the water, because quite often to get a fish to actually take, not just merely follow the fly, but take, we need to suddenly accelerate the movement of the fly, and if the fly isn't balanced properly, they will tend to roll on their side, and at that point it's usually game over. Fishes realize it's a fake and they're off. So balance of the fly is important. They should have good motion in the wing and tail of the fly, so the proper degree of sparseness, but yet giving it some bulk and appearance is important, so that you get movement in the fly. And then another common thing that we find with the flies we use is all of them have some sort of large head configuration that I believe pushes water, and it signals or at least attracts the fishes or triggers their feeding instinct by impulses along their lateral line.
What size hooks do you use? We had a question come in on the Internet. Patty up in Oregon want to know what size hooks. And also, what colors are you working with there?
Okay. As far as the hook size, the other pattern that I didn't mention is that we do throw a lot of clouds or minnows, and very, very adaptable fly, and the ballyhoo imitations, we call them the clouserhoo or tie on those. The clousers we tend to tie fairly small on the hook, larger on the weight of the head, so that they turn that hook up and it doesn't roll. So one-aughts, two-aughts would be a large size. The bucktail deceivers, most of them we tie on 2-aught to 3-aught. Now, when we get into the gin socks and the Baja muddlers, 5-aught, 6-aught size. And as far as color comp goes, from my experience on the roosters, that's probably the least of our considerations. Most of these fish are predominantly white to pearlescence on their sides. What the fish sees is somewhat different than what we see. You've got the darker contrasting top, but that's kind of a bird's eye view. What these fish tend to see, especially the rooster fish, quite often they approach that fish or the fly from behind. Now you get offshore, you get species like tuna and all, they're looking at the fly from the bottom side. So keep in mind that different fish approach the fly from different angles and will see the fly differently. But as far as our toppings, sardines generally kind of go from gray to tan to olive. The mullet kind of have a dirty, olivish brown, to their backs, but again, their sides are fairly white pearlescent.
Yeah, because when you said about the tuna come up from the reefs or structure below and shoot up and grab things.
Is exactly right. And skipjack do the same thing. They come from fairly deep water straight up. The exception to that is if we're out chasing tuna that are on the surface feeding with porpoise, then about anything works in there. They're really keyed up, and you get about anything in front of them, they'll eat. But then they're seeing a side profile. But most of the time we're bringing them up off of the deeper reefs, and they are looking at the bottom side of that fly.
Well, we have another question here from Frank in Lanceville, British Columbia. Frank has submitted a whole bunch of great questions tonight. But this one says, he's told that roosters can be an aggressive fish. Will they take poppers or surface flies, or do you always have to fish below the surface for them?
No, actually, there are days, especially low-light conditions in morning and evening, that especially what I like is a crease fly, and we'll switch off and try crease flies. But I've had good luck on poppers, and we certainly use surface plugs, hookless surface plugs, as a teaser, and we'll get into that on the tactics and fishing from the beach, and it's also effective from the boat. Yeah, it does pay to play with the poppers on these fish.
Great. Well, let's get into those strategies and tactics now. And again, another question from Frank in British Columbia. He says, is fishing for the rooster fish in the surf something that one can do on their own, or would you suggest hiring a guide?
I would say on this, and I'm a great one for people learning and doing things on their own. Fishing for rooster fish is a very specialized type of fishing. They move and change. They're not on the same spots every day. You might get 2 or 3 days of fairly consistent action on one section of beach, and then it'll move. What a guide can do is put you on to where the fish are, how to locate them, get you in and keep coaching on the stripping techniques and the delivery to the fish, you're working the beach. It takes a while to figure out how far you need to get ahead of those fish if they're moving along the beach to set up and cast to them. I would recommend at least doing at least 1 day with a guide while you're down there to give you a leg up, and it's a steep learning curve on these fish.
You had talked in your book, and you were telling a story about two clients you had, one that was following the directions based upon your experience and success rate, and one that was kind of following their own lead, so to speak. You want to go into that a bit more and tell us about what you learned from that?
What I relate in that book was kind of one of those, oh my gosh, kind of things that I realized why it took me so long, and probably collectively the fly fishing community, to catch on to what happens with rooster fish, and developing kind of a stages of feeding activity and how they feed. And one of the things that we've had happen with rooster fish is you can get them to follow.
They're quite curious, but getting a fish to follow the fly doesn't necessarily mean that they have any intention of eating the fly. The important thing is the things that we do to get them to eat. Now that, you really start narrowing it down to certain types of presentations and stripping technique and working the fish. And I think where we've gone astray in our approaches to rooster fish is we hit that period of what we call a stage 4 fish, and we'll get into a little bit of that later, where they are super aggressive, super keyed up, and a lot of things work. And previous to that, we've been fishing along and having refusal after refusal after refusal, and all of a sudden you got fish that are hitting, and I think it has led us to thinking that we found the magic bullet and the magic way to strip, and so then you go and do that for quite a while, and then you're missing the opportunities on normal fish behavior. And that's exactly what I had with these two gentlemen. Great guys, but the first day was one of those magic days where everything worked, and so he was kind of stuck on the things that worked that day, and it was hard to get him off of some of that and back to some very key basic approaches. And that's fairly typical. The fish play minds with our games without knowing it, in terms of, especially these guys, because they'll come right up on the fly, look really excited, and turn off. And I don't know how many times I have people throw up their hands and go, "What am I doing wrong?" And they're not doing anything wrong at all. It's just that these fish can be very, very tough to get to sell and have them actually eat the fly rather than just follow it.
So what you're saying is, based, and this kind of goes back to, hiring a guide, especially, is, and I do that almost whenever I go to a new area, whether it's trout fishing or saltwater or whatever, because I haven't spent enough time down there to understand these and to know the percentages. And that's kind of what you're talking about here, is percentages. Is, if you do it a certain way that eventually you will hook up, whereas another one has a, 10% chance and the other way has a 80% chance. So
that's right, and I find that it's exhausting. It's exhausting to present to these fish properly, to make the cast, start the strip while the fly is in the air, and strip hard, either single hand or double hand, and then pick it right back up and put it right back down, and strip hard every time. And it is tiring, and it takes a good guide to keep the positive energy flowing, the coaching going, and in a good positive way, to where people keep working at it, because they can get very frustrated on these fish.
Well, there again, if you have somebody that's got that experience and you trust in them, then that regardless of what's happening, you're doing the right thing. But if you go out there blindly on your own the first time around, you could be fishing for 3 days doing the wrong thing for 3 days and be even more frustrated. So I think that experience always pays off. And to be able to use others' experience like that. So.
Yeah, especially on the rooster fish. There's a lot of other species that you can key in to pretty quick, you know, without the use of a guide. But in this case, a guide can be invaluable. And one of the things we do, too, we get a lot of people in the hotel that aren't guided. Don't come guided, and we do a lot of talking with those folks and trying to help them in the evenings after fishing and kind of hold little seminars and people do well coming down on their own. Just guiding does give you a kind of a boost in terms of flattening out that learning curve.
Well, we have a question here from Angelo in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, and his question is what are generally the best areas to get roosters consistently in the surf. So I guess we're talking, you know, about structure and currents and all that kind of thing, but can you go into that and tell us?
There's several places, you know, and I kind of mentioned a few earlier in the broadcast where we normally find roosters. There's two Punta Arenas, one right there on the East Cape, the other is off the tip of Sorabo. Both are fairly major projections of sand that stick right out into the currents, the Sea of Cortez, and you get backwater eddies off of those currents, just like you do in a river. And so you get a lot of food for the bait fish in those areas. So points, sandy points that create back eddy is good. We also find too, though, that bays are good. Fraley's Bay is a good spot. Right in front of Hotel Punta Colorado is a little bay that are natural bait fish traps. So inside the inner part of bays and coves are good places to lurk. Look for fish. We also look on the sandy beaches for finger bars, offshore bars, to where you've got a good trough between your offshore bar and right along the beach. A lot of times when we're setting up for fish that are cruising, we'll move back to those points that funnel the fish right next to the shoreline as much as we can. We like to get a fish that's paralleling the shore and very close in. So, yeah, we are looking at structure all the time from the standpoint of funneling fish, but also, too, where the food source is going to get pushed into.
So when you say you have an offshore bar there, sandbar, you're creating a trough between that and the beach, and the fish will come in there, and is that where they kind of trap or hunt?
Yeah, I can think of several places that we fish consistently right in around the lighthouse, Punta Arena, up off of the town of La Rivera. The wave action digs off the beach and piles that sand up on the outside, and you'll see those fish pushing bait over the top of those shallow bars and then trapping them in the fairly narrow channels right on the beach. A low tide that's just starting to turn and move is one of my favorite times to fish for these fish. Those bars are fairly exposed, but you're also starting to get that current change to where that you're getting some current movement, and that affects the ability of the bait fish to escape, and they're fighting current, they're fighting the roosters crashing through them. So yeah, structure is an important aspect.
What's the depth in one of those troughs that you'd be fishing?
Oh gosh, you know, depending on the tide, but they'll definitely, you know, be in over your head where you can go back out and almost stand on the outside bar. In fact, we were doing a fly fishing destination show, and that's exactly what we did. We swam across the trough with our rods, and we were actually standing in knee-deep water on the outside bar and fishing trough on both sides. actually, I remember we caught several nice roosters that day.
Well, we have Shane in Alaska wants to know what techniques he used for chasing roosters from the boat or from the beach. So do you want to kind of give us, kind of go in depth here for us, Mike? And maybe you start with the beach, because I know you use different approaches from the beach than you do working the surf zone from a boat. So let's start with the beach and maybe just tell us, you know, how, you know, if you go out in the morning, what your strategy is and what you actually do.
Quite often our strategy is to take advantage of the full day and what it offers. Because the Sea of Cortez has tremendous variety. We'll start first light and blind cast on structure. A lot of times we'll go out to Lighthouse Point. and worked that, or way inside what they call the Rincón de Tesos. And there it's a blind casting or looking for fish that are working the surface. Quite often what we catch at this hour are ladyfish, smaller jacks, smaller roosters, occasional pargo, lookdowns, occasional pompano. But as the sun comes up, then we start looking for the cruising roosters. At this point, the sun gets high enough that we can actually see them moving. And, you know, the experience of the previous day, I do a lot of talking with the captains in the morning, if I've got a beach trip even, because I can get a lot of last-minute intelligence from those guys. The other people I talk to, too, are the guys that gather live bait for the boats, because they're out there, you know, first daylight, and their observations a lot of times are really key. So we move to places where we expect the fish to be circulating along the beach. Some of the keys there, of course, is where are the schools of mullet. And when you find mullet, very likely you're going to find big roosters. We'll patrol the beach. There's a few areas that four-wheelers have not been prohibited. You know, that can all change this spring. But either walking and standing on certain points that these fish tend to come by, but we're watching for fish circulating. And depending on whether it's a rising tide or falling tide, they'll generally be coming either north or south. And and you'll get a predominance of those fish working into the tidal current, heading one direction until the tide turns. So you can focus your looking for the fish in the direction that they're coming from. At that point, it's a matter then of getting in front of the fish well before the fish get there. And they close very, very rapidly. The idea being is that they're 10, 15 feet right off of dry sand. They're working right along that trough line. And, at that point, then we get down low so we don't spook the fish and try to put a big mullet fly basically right off of their nose and pull straight away. The cast is probably 40 to 50 feet, generally not more than that. And either using, depending on the skill level of the angler, I like a double hand strip off the beach if the angler can start moving the fly as soon as it hits the water. And that's one of the key aspects, boat or beach, is that once that fly hits the water, it's moving. And that's the first thing that fish sees, is that prey moving away from them. At that point, if the fish starts to charge on the fly, then you need to accelerate the movement of the fly, either by hand stripping faster, but generally what we end up doing is actually sweeping the rod to accelerate. We call it scissor strip. If the fish doesn't take, then we'll pick it up and we'll cast it right back on the fish's nose. The other times, and this seems that we seem to see this more in the afternoon as the wind comes up and it starts to really push a lot of food stuff for the mullet in the afternoons, you know, 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. That's when we'll see the roosters come straight in on the beach. Sometimes you'll see them actually in the waves, coming straight in on the beach. Again, you make the cast straight out to them. And strip right back. What you don't want to do is anything past a crossing shot. The crossing shot to me is a Hail Mary on most of these fish. Occasionally you'll get one to turn, but your best shot is casting straight on the nose and pulling straight away from the fish. Cross the fish, or especially if you throw a shot as a fish goes past you and you're pulling it back towards them, that's a spooked fish. I discourage our clients from taking anything but good shots. Let the fish go by if you don't have a good shot. It's very likely they'll circulate and come back around. You want good, quiet fish. Blow a shot on them, spook them. It'll be a while before you'll get another shot on them.
Okay, so let's say I'm, you know, scouting the beach. And this is actually a question Frank up in British Columbia had, too. He said in my description I had talked about stalking. Does this mean you're sight fishing for them in the surf, and you've pretty much identified that you are, but you're also doing some blind casting? But let's say I'm going, working my way up the beach, I see straight out perpendicular from me a rooster working there. What do I do next?
One option, the fish that are, say, paralleling the shore, but far enough out that you've got to throw a cast 90 degrees across them, We carry, as a guide, we carry a spinning rod with a hookless teaser on it. And if you're unguided, what I recommend is you take turns, one with the fly rod and one with the teasing rod. What you might have a chance on this sort of fish is throw that teaser out, and I'd cast that ahead of them, pass them ahead of them, and then bring that in, and hopefully the fish will turn and follow the teaser in. Then the person with the fly rod has a much better chance that fish is coming in behind that teaser. He's now coming straight at you on the beach to where that you can put that fly in front of the teaser so that as you start to move it, the teaser comes up past the fly. He can jerk the teaser out. You strip the fly, and hopefully you'll get a fish to take.
Okay, so you do use teasing techniques from the beach. It sounds like it takes a little bit more practice and expertise to do it, but you can do that from the beach. The other thing that I kind of picked up on, I think, is that, you know, a lot of fish will take a fly on the drop. In other words, you strip, and as it drops is when they take it, but it sounds to me like they're taking it as it speeds away. Am I right on that?
I have seen a few, and I'll emphasize a few roosters, take a fly on the dead drop. That they generally don't. And if you slowly retrieve down in most situations on these fish, they're off it. And the tendency for people is that after they've had refusal after refusal of fast strips and the fish turns off last minute to slow it down and in effect kind of feed the fish. I have seen that happen on a stage 4 fish. In fact, what I write about in the book, the two guys, that's exactly what happened to this guy. He slowed down the retrieve on several occurrences, like you do with trout, it works with bass, and the fish still ate it. And so when he got refusals on the high-speed retrieves, he'd go back to the dead drop or slowing it down. Generally that, you'll blow the opportunity on the fish. The high percentage game with these guys is a strip and then strip faster yet, when they turn on it. Now we do fish dead drop, especially if we're chumming, bits of, dead fish for jacks. It can be deadly it's absolutely deadly on tuna. In fact, we probably catch more fish on the dead drop for tuna than we do with the high speed retrieve at the surface. What we kind of find down there is that either a fast, consistent to accelerating retrieve works, or the dead drop, but not on rooster fish.
Not on rooster. They like to chase, it sounds like.
They like to chase it down. They definitely like.
Why don't you answer your phone there? We'll take a quick break here. And we'll be right back.
See you in an office here in town, so.
Okay,
it must be an after-hour call.
Okay. When we return, we'll be answering more of these questions on strategies and tactics with Mike and Roosters in the Surf. Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's Fly Fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net or email at Pudge, that's P-U-D-G-E, at womensflyfishing.net or call them at 907-274-7113. We're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Mike Reeser about roosters and surf. If you'd like to ask Mike a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive it immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them on the show tonight as possible. Before we get back to the tactics, Mike, I did receive a message from Phil Panko. He's one of our devoted listeners out there. And he says there's a couple of great animated knot tying websites out there, and he suggests knotpro.com and animatedknots.com. So knotpro.com and animatedknots.com. Those might be places to learn how to tie knots in an animated fashion, which would be nice. So. Okay, more tactics. So from the beach, is that the primary strategy you use, is looking and sight fishing after the sun gets up and you're just hunting fish most of the time?
That is I think the most challenging, most interesting interesting game. You can continue to blind cast for fish. It generally doesn't provide many larger fish, but you can catch smaller fish. But no, we're generally working high points on the dunes, moving along the beach and looking for fish. I'm also watching too for bird activity to alert us to whether fish are pushing bait up on the beach. A lot of times you'll see the frigate birds circling, pelicans diving. Definitely you've got something going on down the beach. Try to get down there and catch it before the feeding activity ends.
But primarily it's a sight fishing.
It's hunting. Hunting, and there's some days that you do an awful lot of looking and very little casting. Other days it's during the peak of the season. It's not unusual to have a shot every 10 or 15 minutes during the peak. Right, turning of the tide and all. You won't get it all day long. But there seems to be each day about a magic two-hour period in there that the fish are on the beach hunting and susceptible to being caught on the fly.
Well, that kind of leads into a question from Mike McEwen from South Africa. He says, what is the success rate? How many fish per day? How many fish landed per hookup?
Oh, man.
Stats on that?
Oh, no. It's kind of like permit fishing. There's when it's ripe, you can catch multiple fish. When we're talking, if we're strictly talking large rooster fish, if you go home after 3 or 4 days and you've caught one large fish out of the surf, you're doing well. But keep in mind the variety of species and opportunity presents itself. Like I said, there's about a two-hour magic period of good fishing. The rest of the day, we quite often will start to, focus on maybe on some other species. So you do get hookups there. Now, on the smaller roosters, there's a lot more of them. You got a lot of smaller fish, but as they mature, their populations thin out due to, natural causes. So the 4 to 6, 8 pound fish, and more often from the boat, we'll have days of literally we'll get into the 20s and sometimes even 30s on the boat with the medium-sized fish when you hit a good hot bite. And we've had days on the beach where you might get 6, 8 medium-sized fish and then shots at bigger fish. This is not a numbers game, especially on the big fish. It is right. A lot of patience. It's exciting. Quite often the feedback I get from clients that do a variety of things, blue water, inshore on the boat, and the beach fishing, even though they don't catch something on the beach or maybe get one fish, quite often that's their favorite day, is just the thrill of trying to hook up with a very, very difficult quarry.
Well, let's talk, you just mentioned boats, so that's the other way we can work the surf zone. So tell us, your approach there and your strategies, and you keep mentioning stage this and stage that. Why don't you do a bit of explaining about these stages you've been referring
to? We apply the stages to our boat fishing just because we can encounter a wider variety of fish in terms of their feeding activity. And when we started going from 2 to 3 fish to the boat to 20 and 30 fish, it was kind of really led by observing fish behavior. And the stages are kind of categorized from one, which is kind of your beginning stage of feeding activity, where they're starting to kind of go more from curiosity to starting to feed, up to stage 4. Now, we predominantly use a live bait teaser for roosters. Now, we're working the small to medium-sized fish. We'll hook a sardina on a small snap swivel, put it on a leader swivel, and then a little bobbin above that. And that's mainly so people can see where that live bait is in the water. It works as a little bit of a target, keeps them from also crossing their cast across the line that we're working as a teaser line. And then for the bigger roosters, then we're using usually a mullet back there. So stage one, what is happening here is the rooster fish approaches from behind. They're kind of cautious. They come in slower, and generally won't even eat the live bait teaser. They're, you know, the swimming of that little guy on attached to a line is odd enough to them. Their wariness tells them it's not anything to eat. But if you throw a live chum in the water, they'll eat it, but they'll swim quite a ways away from the boat and pounce on it. Now, some of our listeners have probably experienced this technique, and some of the captains that aren't as aware of fly fishing techniques will keep throwing live chum in the water, and you see fish busting all over, but you can't reach them, and if they're not going to take the live bait teaser, it's going to be tough to get them on the fly. Stage two, we differentiate that. This is when the rooster, when they approach, they come in a little faster. They start to comb out. They get in their little zigzag motion there right behind the teaser, and they'll follow the teaser ways, but then they'll start to eat it. This is the point where it becomes more possible to catch fish on the fly, and what is really critical at this point is that the cast is made and repeatedly made right back to the teaser within 3 feet of that teaser, stripped hard 3 or 4 times, no more than that, picked up, and then repositioned right back to that. Now, the reason that we keep it coming back to that teaser is those fish are on that teaser for such a short period of time. They're on it. The person handling the teasing rod generally at this point only has to maybe crank the reel 2 or 3 times. It doesn't look natural to them. They're off. And if the fly lands right then at that time, is stripped away from them, you get a reaction strike. The hard thing with people is they strip back to the boat. The fish will follow, and they want to strip all the way back to the boat because the fish is following. And I'm usually saying back to the teaser, because that fish that follows probably is not going to eat. The fish that you're getting at this stage is going to be a reaction strike. You want to get that fly right back on the teaser for the next fish that's come up and is starting to play behind it. At this point, we still don't throw live chum because they'll follow it off away from the boat and pull away from any shot that you might have. We get into stage three in the feeding development of the fish. This is when they come hard on the live teaser, and they'll come fast. At this point, the person handling the teasing rod has got to move the fly or move the teaser fairly quickly away from them, or they're going to strip it off of there. It makes a challenge for the fly fisherman because suddenly that teaser is moving at a fairly fast rate towards them, and the tendency is to overcast the teaser, strip the fly up from behind the fish. That generally won't get a strike. So they've got to kind of time the cast to where it's still in front. And this is why this little plastic bubble in front, 4 feet in front, kind of helps give them a little bit of automatic lead to where that when the fly hits the water, hopefully at that point the person handling the teasing rod has got that fish right up to where the fly is. Again, 3 or 4 hard, fast strips, sweep, pick it up and put it right back. Don't mess too much with the fish that's following. You're losing opportunity at the teaser. Now, one of the things that happens at this point, these fish are getting excited enough to eat. This is when we start putting live chum in the water, and then you start getting the feeding frenzy behind the boat. You can start to cast a little bit more to those feeding fish. Stage four is something we don't see that often, but the feeding activity is such, you can't even begin to work a teasing rod. As soon as that little sardina hits the water, it's stripped. So at this point, we're just introducing live swimmers in the water, keeping the feeding frenzy going, and then people are basically casting to the swimming sardinas.
So when you're saying you've got this feeding, you know, this progression of feeding going on, are you looking out and seeing multiple fish out there? Can you see them, or are they just coming up, so to speak, out of the depths to attack these teasers?
Well, there's times when you can't see them, and that makes it really hard because you can't read the fish behavior. If you've got you know, cloudy skies, sun angles low, or if we're over slightly deeper water, or say something that's got a rock bottom or a seagrass bottom, it's a little harder to see them come up. But quite often we're working, you know, within 50, 100 feet of the beach over sandy bottom, and if the sun's right, yeah, you can see them coming. And that is the real key, is gauging that fish behavior by how they're reacting to both the live teaser and whatever chum we introduce to the water, kind of tells us what stage those fish are in. And and then how tight you need to be casting right to that teaser. The lower stages, you got to be right on the teaser, or you're probably not going to get a hookup. In fact, at stage one, what we'll do is not even cast at the teaser as we're going along. Hold the shot out until you actually get a fish that is gets worked up on the teaser. Then make the presentation. You don't want to show, tip your hand and show them that fly to where they get used to it. It's got to be a total reaction strike on them.
Okay, let's rewind here a little bit and go back to the beginning. We don't really, well, to find these fish using the boat, okay, we're opposite of the beach now. We're not walking up the beach. So we're again looking for this bait fish or bird activity prior, or do you use the teaser as kind of a blind, you know, method of attracting them? How do we find the fish?
Well, both ways. You know, there's no locations that we find them. The balls of sardines are usually quite evident. You can see nervous water from them, their little tails out of the water. The water will be kind of a brownish black blob, and we'll look for those areas and then work in around there. But definitely the teaser is what makes the roosters apparent. The first piece of intelligence I gather in the morning is when we get our live bait. Is I'm talking with the guys that are netting at in the early daylight hours, the sardinas and mullet, and asking them where are you seeing feeding activity. And just even knowing where they're getting the bait is a good first step. So we focus our attention on the presence of bait, the presence of seeing fish feeding activity, and it's very apparent. I mean, roosters like to take their prey right on the surface. They use the wonderful comb of theirs as sort of a living net to crowd and position the bait to where they can get it in their mouth. So when they're feeding, it's quite evident. You'll see the slashes and feeding activity on the fish. But definitely, when none of those are present, just being able to move with the boat up and down the beach in good areas, you can cover a lot of ground with that live teaser behind the boat to find the fish. As my partner John says, the ocean's a big bucket, and you've got to cover some ground to be able to find where those fish are.
So if a person was coming down there for the first time and going after roosters, sounds like you might suggest to try a little bit of both. Do a little bit of beach walking and get out in the boat and attack them from both sides.
Oh, yeah. A very good percentage of our folks will, in the course of the time that they spend with us, will opt to do some beach fishing and some boat fishing. Gives a kind of a different perspective. It's a different experience. Beach fishing definitely is the height of the game in terms of your skills and the challenge. The boat fishing is a lot more action and cover more ground, get to kind of get used to how these fish feed, how they approach, and get some practice. I recommend doing a day or two on the boat and then doing the beach. Then you're tuned up. You've got a better idea of when you've got the few opportunities on the beach, what you need to do to move the fly to get the hookup, that you learn with repeated casting to feeding fish from the boat. One thing on the boat, when the roosters are in, you're going to get a lot of casting in a day.
Yeah. Good point. I'm glad you brought that up. It looks like we've got one last question on the internet. Edwin Lowe in San Francisco wants to know what kind of lure you're using for your teaser rod. I know you just mentioned you were using some live bait, but you also do use lures, don't you?
We do, and actually I'll switch off it from time to time on the boat too, and throw a lure out with a spinning rod and bring it back in, and there's sometimes that ends up being more effective than the live bait. But probably our favorite lure is the Ranger lure, and they're hard to find. They're actually an East Coast design for bluefish and stripers. Probably the second one that we use is a cotton cordell. It's like a pencil popper. Yuzari Bull is a pretty good one. The all of them have a characteristic. They tend to ride with the nose up out and the tail of the lure in the water and a lot of side-to-side wiggle and spraying of water.
Okay. Now, it sounds like this is where you've made the great strides that you have in figuring out the fishes with the staging, understanding more what the fish are actually doing and how they're feeding so that you can present in the correct manner. So am I correct in that? That's kind of your breakthrough here?
Oh, yeah, you're right on. As we started to develop, you know, the ideas of how to get fish hooked up, then the next thing as a working guide is, okay, how do you explain this to somebody and keep them focused on doing the right thing and happy and positive with all of the refusals that you get. And it also helped, too, with the boat captains to understand the different phases in terms of the chumming aspect so we don't over-chum. And these guys are, you know, great on reading fish behavior. So, they clicked in on this approach really quick so that we're in sync between what we're doing at the back of the boat with the teasing rod and what they're doing in terms of maybe throwing some live chum in there.
Well, great. I've learned a lot tonight, Mike, and as usual, and I need to get down there and
yeah, you
some
do.
Of those flies. Sounds exciting every time we talk. Maybe I could do that, get out of the heat in Colorado and go down there where it's cooler, only 80.
Well, I'm kind of wondering as I get down there closer to the tropical storm season if it's going to be as nice as it was when I left.
You never know. Never know in the tropics.
Yeah. But it was beautiful when all through the spring and early summer.
Well, unfortunately, it's time. We got to wrap things up here. But, folks, stick around here for the next couple of minutes. We're going to be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, and a selection of saltwater flies from Mike Reeser. So stay tuned to see if you win. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S, Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website, www.familyties.com. That's family and then T-Y-E-S.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and fill out our feedback form on the show. You'll find a link on our homepage in the section where Mike's show is that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on the link and leave your comments. Now it's time to give away our prizes. So the first two are drawings, and we do this from a database. We randomly select from the database. Computer does all the work here. If you haven't registered yet, then it's too late, but make sure you're registered for the next show because we're always giving away some nice gifts. So the first thing we're going to give away is a membership, 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And I'm going to press my button here, and the selection gives me Doug Bannis, and sorry if I pronounce your name wrong, Doug, but Doug, you get that 3-year membership, and Doug's up in British Columbia, Canada, so I know you'll enjoy that, Doug, and it's a great gift. If you already have a membership, then we'll get that extended for you. Now we'll give away a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, and that is out of Canada, Calgary, Canada. Their website is www.flyfusionmag.com. That's www.flyfusionmag.com. Great magazine, and let's see who our winner of the 1-year subscription there is. And we've got Andrew Zelenak in Missouri. Andrew Zelenak. So congratulations to you, Andrew, and I know you'll enjoy it. It's a beautiful magazine and a lot of good how-tos in it. Okay, now, our final giveaway is going to be based on a question I'm going to ask here. And Mike's going to help me out because this is about the show. The first person to submit the correct answer on the homepage of our website will get what, Mike? What flies are you giving them away tonight?
We'll give away 6 flies that we use both beach and inshore and kind of covers the sardine to mullet phase. So 2 gym socks and 2 Baja bucktail deceivers and 2 Baja muddlers.
Great. Sounds like a great gift. And if you get them, then you got to go use them, right, Mike?
You betcha.
Yeah. So, okay, so here's the question, folks. Mike made mention of this many times during the show. There is a bait fish, so to speak, that is the largest of the bunch, and if you want to catch a large rooster, then you'd be trying to simulate this kind of bait fish. And what is the name of that bait fish? So I'm sitting here, Mike, refreshing my screen here, waiting for one of our smart listeners to submit their answer. So first person in, you got to put your name and your location. And we got a taker here. And, Mike, let's see if he's right. Andrew Zelnick, he just won the subscription as well, and his answer is mullet. Is he correct?
He's correct.
He's correct. Well, Andrew, you're a double winner tonight. Congratulations. I don't think that's ever happened on the show, so that's a first. And he's in Missouri, so we'll have to drag his rear down there to Cabo so that he can in the East Cape and do some fishing with those flies. Well, Andrew, do me a favor and shoot me back a message in that text box giving me your email address so that I can communicate with you after the show and get some mailing address instructions and so forth for you so Mike can send you those flies. So, Mike, thanks so much for offering those flies up tonight, and I know Andrew's going to love them. And also, just thank you for being with us again. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, and glad you could share your latest experiences and knowledge with us, and it was very kind for you to do that.
Well, I enjoy talking about it. I wouldn't be in the guiding business if I didn't enjoy sharing what we have learned. And this is an evolving process. We don't have all the answers, believe me. Every year, every season, we learn more, and we keep learning, and we've got a good collection of guides that we all get around and we talk and share information on fish. The boat captains, the Mexican captains we work with, big part of that collective knowledge and observation. So it's a continuing learning process on our part too.
Well, that's what makes fly fishing interesting. If it was always the same and easy, we wouldn't be doing it. So we appreciate all your efforts and glad you're still learning as well. That's a
good thing. Oh yeah.
Well, on our next broadcast, which will be on August 6th, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, on that show we'll be interviewing Matt Snyder, and we're going to move from salt water to warm water, and our show will be Wild Wipers on the Fly. Matt Snyder says that fly fishing for wipers is like hooking up with a strong saltwater fish, only you're in fresh water. Learn Matt's techniques for finding and hooking up with these exciting fish. We'd like to thank Flats Time Charters, Front Range Anglers, Housatonic River Outfitters, and Women's Fly Fishing Alaska for sponsoring our show tonight. If you'd like to sponsor a show and think your company would benefit from that, then give us a call at 1-888-961-1115 extension 2 or email us at info@askaboutflyfishing.com and we'll be happy to explain the options to you. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.